countries where life is better, they feel it's okay to be mediocre. It's not okay. Nobody has to work endless hours. But when you show up, make sure you make it count.
The Startup Sensations podcast. First-hand accounts of the real stories behind the successes, challenges, and opportunities of starting and growing a startup company. From both sides of the pond. With Bulent Osman and Shelley Bays.
And welcome back to another episode of the Startup Sensations podcast with me, Bulent Osman, from, well, still near London here in the UK.
And me, Shelley Bays, in Northern California, where it's raining and sunny and raining and sunny and raining and sunny.
Hello, Shelley. It's very similar over here, actually, in the UK. But I'll tell you what, this particular episode, it will be a ray of sunshine, because we have a wonderful lady called Amber Verdagel. And Amber is a successful entrepreneur. She is an exited tech founder. She founded an app a number of years ago, which was called Pregnancy Plus. And she built it to such a level that a very large company wanted to buy her out. And in fact, she sold it to Philips, the Philips Corporation in Holland, about 6 years ago.
She seems like she's just going to be a super guest and has done wonderful, wonderful things, honestly, from a social standpoint. So we'll have to ask her about her feelings and her motivations for that as well.
And I'm delighted to welcome Amber Verdagel, now joins us from sunny Guildford here in the UK. Amber, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you all for having me. And Shelley, nice to meet you.
Nice to see you, Amber.
Well, Amber, it's a real thrill for us to have you on the show, especially when people realize what you've done in your entrepreneurial career. Amber built up a business with an app called Pregnancy Plus, and you sold it some 6 years ago to Philips.
Yeah, it's been an amazing journey. We started the company in 2012, and it's been an unbelievable success, and I'm really proud of what we've built. It was a very simple idea. It's helping women who get pregnant to guide them through those 9 months. It's a life-changing event. If you get a dog, you do doggy training. If you get a car, you get a car license. And if you want to go swimming, you have swimming lessons. But somehow, when you're pregnant, people are like, good luck. So women need information during those, what is it, roughly 280 days. We guide them through what's happening and how we can support them. There's about 2 million women on the platform every day. And if you say to 2 million women a day, don't drink any alcohol, that's a lot more healthy babies. So it's been an incredible, rewarding journey. Out of the 50 million women to date, we've been able to guide, and it's still the number one pregnancy app worldwide.
That's incredible. And can you tell us about how do you go from a small, humble beginning to something that has that number of people using it?
Well, we were bootstrapped. So in all honesty, it's never the first company you set up that becomes a success. So there were 2 previous app companies that I started. Made a lot of failures, made a lot of mistakes. Learned also a lesson not to work with friends. Doesn't work. And then this company was my 3rd app company I started in 2012. So I had some basic learnings, but I literally had £5,000 to start the business with. And if you want to rank anywhere in the top 5 in health category in the app stores, you need about 5,000 installs a day. If you do any advertising, that's costs you $5,000 a day. So that's close to 2 million marketing budget a year if you want to rank in the top 5 in the health category. That's only the US. So we were in over 100 countries, so, and wanted to be, because we wanted to help women in Indonesia and Brazil and Uganda, everywhere. To be able to do that, you need some clever tricks and a very good product. Because I didn't have a VC that would backing us, and I didn't even know to almost you could get and pick up money. So I just thought, let's just make a really good product and do some creative solutions. So one of the things we did, the app is called Pregnancy Space Plus, which is terrible at the time for SEO, because with Google, when you have the plus, it's just adding keywords. And the company name was called Health and Parenting Limited, which is not a very cool name. I think if I would find a cool name, it would be called The Bump or Nest or any of those names that people come up with. But I did it for a reason, because I needed those keywords for the app store. So health and parenting were my first 2 keywords that I needed. And pregnancy plus that was before there was Disney Plus and Fitness Plus and Digital Plus and all those, was there because I discovered through some testing that the algorithm didn't pick up on the symbols. So whether you added a smiley or a symbol, it would not be seen. So even though there were 2,000 other pregnancy apps in the store, you could not name your app pregnancy, but we needed that keyword pregnancy to rank high. The algorithm cut off the plus, and we had a hard keyword match on pregnancy. In combinations with health and parenting, in combinations with good products, that immediately drove us up the ranking, which was amazing because that meant that we were not bound by any investors that had certain agendas. So we were able to offer the app completely free for the first 3 months to women to help them through the first dreaded trimester, because a lot of women unfortunately experienced miscarriages in those first 3 months. And then after 3 months, we had a one-off upgrade for $5 on some of the content. I think if we were VC-backed, we would have probably introduced very expensive subscriptions, but we didn't have to because our marketing costs were low. And that allowed us to onboard lots and lots of women and also allowed us not to have an app filled with advertising.
So tell me about your exit, because it's quite something to sell an app to the Philips Corporation. You know, it's a big company, obviously. Tell me how that came about and what was the journey of an exit like for you?
At first, of course, I was looking for an exit because at some point we were in over 100 countries and it got very complicated because it's a health app. There were so many rules and regulations in all those different countries that I felt that it was almost going beyond our capabilities. So I wanted to look for an exit to partner up with someone that could really help us to the next level. So we partnered with EY, built all the pitch decks, went on this roadshow. And if you want to do a successful exit, you need to boost your profits. And I didn't want advertising. I didn't want high subscriptions. So I thought, let's do high-quality sponsorships. For example, Dorel Mexicosi would be a great one to teach women on car safety because they have a lot of experience there. Just so they could do sponsored articles. So I hired as someone to do cold calling to find sponsors. That person, I think, I paid £400 a day, but it was our own money. So after 3 days of calling and no leads, I got incredibly nervous. And a week later, I literally said to the team, if there's no appointments, I'm going to call myself next Monday. So we still didn't have appointments. It was a Monday morning. I looked in my network and I found Philips. I'm Dutch myself. Philips is a Dutch company. And I came across someone called Egbert van Acht. He was head of personal health at Philips. And I sent him an invitation. He accepted. And then I sent him a message on LinkedIn saying, hi, Egbert. Fancy a coffee. I've got a pregnancy app I think you should know about. Because Philips had an event with breast pumps and baby bottles and baby monitors. So a week later, I flew out to Holland. I thought I was going to have a coffee, but I was escorted to the 11th floor. And there was the whole Philips team sitting, saying, tell me about your app. So I presented the sponsorship model and why I thought Philips would be great. And they said, we can do sponsorship, but how about an exit? How about we acquire you?
Wow.
And I said, well, you have to hurry up in that case, because we're just on the road with EY. So I said, you have 6 months then, because it will be sold by the summer. And he said, I can make that work. 6 months later, it was sold to Philips, a complete trade deal and a great decision.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, huge congratulations. That's a hell of an effort to do that and a wonderful story. You know, you built this up from scratch, you bootstrapped it and you've sold it to a big company. And I dare say you've made a bit of money out of it. What happens to you, your mindset and your motivation at that level? Do you end up just traveling the world and putting your entrepreneurial shoes up in the air, as it were? Or what do you do?
The moment you receive a significant amount of money in your bank account, you realize that nothing changes. You're still the same person. You still have same ambitions and drives and the same insecurities. So I felt like life is a trick. All this time you think, oh, then I've got paid off my mortgage, then I can buy the clothes that I want. And the moment you have that opportunity, you feel actually a bit ashamed almost that you got this money and someone else didn't. Focused those years on the exit, had a really successful exit with Philips, and then stopped working about a year ago and had some time to reflect. I think most founders that have a significant exit go sit on a boat and then play golf and tennis. So did I. I played a lot of tennis. I did some CEO mentorship roles, some non-executive director roles, which I enjoy. But I did feel that I have like almost an obligation to do something else. Because if you have a talent, and you have the funds, I think as a moral ambition, you should follow. I think that started to emerge about 6 months ago. And I felt I would like to do one more project, another B2C app, but this time I want to fund it myself, but I don't want to start it for an exit. I want to keep it. And the profits we're going to make, I want to give that back to women's health, because I think that's what second-time founders should do. They should come up with an idea to give something back, or become a teacher, or help someone cross the road, but do something. Mm. Don't go sit on a boat and play tennis.
Or a podcast host, eh, Shelley?
Or a podcast host.
When you look back on the successful company and then the two efforts before that, which you said yourself didn't go where you wanted them to go, what are the self-reflections that you have, even though maybe it didn't work out, but what did you do right? What would you change again? What kinds of things would you say are most important to focus on and others to just leave behind?
I think what I'd do differently is I would partner up. And like in America, every tech CEO knows another 30 tech CEOs. Whereas in the UK, I was quite isolated. So I felt like I had to do everything by myself. I felt that I couldn't reach out to other CEOs to ask for help. So I would definitely team up more and learn from others.
Is that networking, or is that that you would have a co-founder?
Yeah, networking, partnerships, co-founder, everything. Sometimes it's just saying, I don't know where to go. What would you recommend, or what do you learn from? People will say fail fast and fail a lot. I failed an awful lot, and I wish I had sometimes failed less and had someone to talk to who said, don't do that. I mean, we were at some point in the Apple store and Google and Windows and Samsung and the Amazon store. Someone should have just said, focus on iOS and Android and then go from there. Don't start on 8 platforms at the same time. We didn't know about functional testing. So we had a terrible app update once where the app crashed terribly and we went from position 1 in the App Store to position 20 because it was so bad. Had I spoken to other app developers, I would have known that you don't release a new app update before it's thoroughly tested on various different devices. So partner up and speak to others, bounce back ideas and fail, but try not to fail on everything.
And what about your team? How did you bring a team together? How did you find people to go on the adventure with you?
Yeah, hire good people. I think that's the key of any good business. I think it is enthusiasm, and it still is. I'm building my new company, and I'm so passionate about what I build. So I start telling people about it. I'm starting to tell them how we are going to change that tiny bit of the world. And they want to join you on that journey. So I think it's passion and it's a vision. It's also, you do need to have a skill to find the right people. I like working with people that are self-motivated. I think you can train people, but you can't train people to be dedicated and to support you and to be self-starters. And I think the core of your business does need those people. And I've always loved working with people that would challenge me, that I didn't have to say, let's go to that direction. They would come on Monday morning and said, I thought about it. Why don't we do X, Y, or Z? I love people that are self-motivated. But you do need to have an eye for it. And I sometimes speak to other founders and CEOs. Sometimes the outcome is that I have to say, I don't think you have the skill to recruit the right people. So maybe someone else should do that. And that's okay, because you have other skills. So I think it starts by finding out what can you do yourself and what can't you do? And it's okay to say you don't have an eye for recruiting the right people.
It's interesting, because one of the differences that we hear a lot, and I've seen a lot in working both in Europe and in the U.S. has this attitude that it's okay to fail. It's okay not to be good at everything. But in Europe, it's a little bit tougher, you know, as you've tried to build teams in companies that are operating all over the world. What do you see culturally?
Yeah, we had a lot of teams all over the world, and you do see those differences massively. In countries where life is better, they feel it's okay to be mediocre. It's not okay. Nobody has to work endless hours. But when you show up, make sure you make it count. And I had a huge respect for the teams in India we worked with Philips. We had a massive development team when we after we saw the company was a team in Bangalore, and they were brilliant. But what we did feel is that they were so supportive that they sometimes wouldn't think as if it was their company. They would just do what you asked them to. So one of the first meetings I would have with the team in India was saying, from now on, you are going to work as if this is your company. And if you don't agree with me, you need to step up and I'll reward you for challenging me. And I would frequently ask, if you were in my shoes, what would you do? Because I wanted to know what they were thinking, because so much knowledge is there. And we did a lot of cross-functional teams. So because we were in over 100 countries, we had an awful lot of translations to do and customer service. We have about 100,000 customer service tickets, 150,000 store reviews to respond to in all these languages. In every country, we found a midwife who gave up her job and had a family but still wanted to work. So she worked from home, did our customer service tickets. She was local. She knew healthcare. But then we found out that if the developer is stuck with a translation on a button, the process would be that he would think, oh, there's someone missed this translation. Then he would send an email to our team that we then had to send to the translation agency, who would translate those words, then would go back in the tickets and go back to the developer. So what we did is we asked the customer service ladies if they were okay if the development team would contact them directly. So then the developer in Bangalore would call my customer service lady in Egypt and said, I'm struggling with this word or this button in Arabic because it's not there. What's the word we're going to put here? And she knew the app better than anyone else. So the translation would happen instantly. And then we asked them to contribute to articles, or we asked them to make smaller translations because we always could get them checked by an editor. But they knew, they went through so many customer service tickets, they were on the ground, they knew the local communities, so they knew what content was important in those countries. And it made customer service so much more interesting for them because they felt they were creating elements of the app.
It's so important to get that real basic understanding of what's going on in that country or in that place.
I set up this new company now, and I thought I'd quite fancy becoming an anonymous CEO. So internally, I'm the CEO. You can look it up in a company's house. But I thought, what if we have a CEO in Uganda and a CEO in Indonesia and in Japan? We can still have local CEOs that run the content for the app in those countries. So we're looking to set up a menstrual app worldwide. But it's such a varied topic that I think we really need CEOs in all these different countries. If you have a podcast in Uganda or in Brazil, I don't show up. Someone else there shows up and tells about the product. It's vanity to want to be the face of a large company worldwide. I don't think that serves the right purpose.
Amber, could I take you back now to probably the young Amber? You were brought up in Holland, in the Netherlands. And I know you had a very specific upbringing, which is probably what shaped you to be this, you know, super successful entrepreneur that you are today. Can you just share with the audience a bit about your background and your upbringing?
My parents came from Amsterdam. They were very cool, eccentric creators. My dad was an architect. My mom had an art gallery in Amsterdam. And in the 70s, they decided to move to the countryside, so a very small village. We lived in this house, and near us was a windmill and a dike. I probably was wearing clogs when I was a child. It was a very conservative village. And my parents were real assets to the village and the community there. But they stood out. The first thing my dad did was paint the in and outside of the house completely yellow. He removed every single door he could find. Luckily, I had a door on my bedroom and there was a door on the toilet. But I think it was one of the first open space living spaces. And so they were incredibly creative and unique. And to give you a few examples, we had a slate stone floor in the house, very dark slate. And my mum allowed me to make chalk drawings on the floor. Normally, any sensible parent would say, don't make a mess, don't make too much drawings, or tidy up after you finish. I was encouraged to make 8-10 meter tall drawings. And then my parents would leave it there for days to admire it. And then on Friday, my mum would mop the floor, and then I was allowed to start again. I remember one day I borrowed a pony I wrote to my parents' house and I rang the doorbell. And my dad answered. He said, "What can I do for you?" And I said, "I'd like to ride the pony indoors." And he said, "That's a ridiculous idea. Why would you want that?" And I said, "I just want to know what it feels to ride a pony inside." And he was like, "You know what? Go on then. Go through the kitchen, around the dining table, one lap and out you get." There were boundaries. I once built 7 dens in the house, like a blanket under the staircase. And I think my dad got a bit upset and he said at some point, "Amber, 7 dens in a house is enough. If you build number 8, you need to destroy number 1. And I thought that was great. There were some boundaries. But that creative freedom that you could do anything really makes who I am today. And I'm really grateful for the first 10 years. Of course, those stories never end well. My dad got ill, got hospitalized. He lost his job. And my parents divorced. I moved with my mum and my little brother to a tiny council house and we had no money because my mum never built up her career. So she got depressed, probably menopause, but at the time you didn't know what menopause was. So there we were, 2 parents that were ill and a little brother. And that was the moment I decided I needed to take control. So I probably would have chosen a creative study, but instead I studied economics and finance because I thought, I need to make sure I'll be able to make money in life. And I'm so grateful for what my parents did. They were so cool. Those first 9 years of my life really made who I am today. And I encourage everyone who have children to allow children to be children and to be creative and clean up the mess later and let them have that freedom because that makes that you can think differently.
I'm not sure a pony would fit in my house. That's the only problem.
It didn't fit in the house there either. It was a tiny pony. And it was a really bad idea.
I think you're absolutely right. The freedom to do things and try things is an important element in creating an entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur. But how did you start to focus on this concept of women's health in particular? What led you down that road? There are lots of ways to, you know, exhibit and use creativity. But in that particular topic, what was it that drove you that direction?
Well, it happens gradually. So over the years, if you let 150 million users pass through your app, you read all those customer service tickets, you start to see the issues. I mean, there's 800 women dying every year in the US from pregnancy-related complications. You see the inequality in healthcare, and then women are hit hard. And I think the next app I'm going to do is menstrual health. I mean, that's another massive topic. It's not very cool, but it's 50% of the population. There's countries where it's really hard to talk about blood. There are no solutions. There's period poverty is massive, but not only in third world countries, but also in the UK, in the US. It's a huge topic. So once you start to read more about it, learn more about it, I think there is such a missed opportunity. And I also believe that healthcare apps, the ones that are around, most are VC-backed. And VC backing has its space. If you require a lot of capital to start a product or research or clinical trials, it's really beneficial. But for a B2C product, I think funding health apps is not the right decision. You need to earn 10x back. You're either going to do that by selling their data, which they do, or having very hefty subscriptions. And that means that women who want access to pregnancy or menstrual health apps, they are faced with $30 a year subscriptions. And that means that not only the women who are in the top 1% can afford those subscriptions, and the need is pretty vulnerable. And I think there are very few apps that focus on the entire population. So it's a process. And the more you learn about it, the more you feel passionate about finding solutions for these women.
With your new venture, Amber, and you've already spoken a little bit about it just now, what lessons do you take from your past and from your previous experience to this new company? What are you going to do that's slightly different to maybe you did before? Because on this show, we always like to share as much advice to our listening audience as possible. So if you can share any of your secrets, that would be wonderful.
Right. So I started by thinking, what do I want? Rather, how am I going to make money or how are we going to scale this? I just thought, what would I like this product to look like? And I thought I'd love an app reaching 125 million women a month in over 100 countries, but it should be completely free. So if that is your ambition, then you need either an awful lot of funding or a creative solution. What I learned previously is that data is incredibly complicated to keep safe and secure. So I thought, what if I don't have any data? Because everyone says data is money. But what if data in health apps is a hassle? So I literally went back to thinking, when I built apps in 2008, we didn't have any cloud service. It's also very sustainable because you don't have those environmentally or friendly cloud servers running all day. And there's other ways. So we started literally ideating how would a tech backend look with on-device AI, with different systems to be able to have no cloud service. So I'm not saying we can't do research. I'm not saying you can't back up, but it won't be on our servers. Because then when I scale to 100 million women, I don't scale in costs. And that's a way to make the app free because I can make a one-off investment to build this app and to maintain it. Our team was incredibly small when we sold to Philips. And then over the years, because of the funding that Philips, of course, had available, we mushroomed out to 80 people. I don't want to go back to large teams. So one of the lessons is I want to think again, how can we run that with 10, 20 people? How would you do that today? And I think on-device AI is very new, but it's going to be groundbreaking. And I think that allows us to be much more clever. So maybe we can also make 100 million with this app. We maybe only need 10 million to run the company, and then we can give 90 million back to free temples, to women's research. And I think a second-time founder doesn't do it for the money anymore. So if we make substantial amounts of money, it's going back to the community. And I'm really passionate about this because our governments are bankrupt and the big corporations don't have any social responsibility. So we need to have people in between that have assets, that have ambition, that have companies that say, this money that we're making is not going to investors. It's not going to anyone's bank account. It's going back to people that need it the most. And that social responsibility, yeah, I think that's what's missing. There's a great book in Holland called Moral Ambition by Rutger Bregman. And I can't agree more. He actually says that there's a lot of people with jobs that if you go on strike, nobody misses you. And if you have one of those, maybe start thinking what else you could do, even if it's a few hours a day, because our governments are not going to do it anymore.
Absolutely right. I couldn't agree more on that. So these health apps that you have developed focus on women. As you recruit for your teams, your companies, do you feel the need to just have women?
It starts by hiring the best people, whether that's a man or a woman. So for me, that's the most important thing, because if we have a great product, we can touch a lot of lives. But it goes naturally, I think, for certain roles, I require women. And especially if we're going to create content or menstrual apps, I think that's an obvious role there. I've always had very diverse teams, but that's because you look for the best person for that job. And because the jobs are so diverse, you'll have a lot of diversity in roles. We're also going to make a version for men, by the way, to understand the cycles of a woman better. It's going to be very cool.
Us men tend to be a little clueless about some of these things. So any education is always very welcome. Can you just share your thoughts about the future of entrepreneurship, especially with the technology that we have today that seems to be growing ever so quickly, especially around artificial intelligence? What impact will that have, and how optimistic are you for our futures?
The impact is going to be massive. How that will look, I don't know. There's people say, oh, we'll move to universal basic income. That sounds nice. But then are we also going to do that income for people in Indonesia and India? And I mean, what is universal? Are we going to then support everyone? So these are really difficult questions. Life's going to change. I think if my grandchildren will later say, oh, granny, can you still write? Because I think handwriting will be a skill that we won't learn anymore in the future because you don't need it. So jobs will change. I think there's opportunity for more people to have access to starting a company because you will be able to code without a coding team or without coding knowledge. You can do text to code. So I think if you have ambition, you will be able to start from anywhere in the world and start any business. So maybe we go back to a lot more local shops, local solutions, which gives a lot of disadvantaged people access to something. But you do need to be involved. I mean, AI is going to join us, whether we like it or not. Don't fight it. Use it. And the more you learn about AI, the more you see it's not actually that scary.
We all have to embrace it for sure. Well, on that point, Amber, we thank you very much for your time. I'm sure Everyone is inspired by your story. So many people want to get in touch. What's the best way for people listening to this show to get in touch with you?
LinkedIn. I think that's the easiest way to get in touch. I think more important is, why do you want to get in touch? When you get in touch, don't be English, I'm Dutch. So straight away say, I need you for this, or can you help me with that? And then I can give you a very direct answer. If there's anyone that want to make a difference to millions of women around the world and want to help me with this new venture, reach out as well, because I can't do it by myself. This is something that I need. And anyone that has any influence to help me make this a success.
Just in this conversation, you've been very inspirational. So keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Well, Shelley, I thought that was a really impressive conversation with Amber.
Oh, it was definitely impressive. Her description of how her very early childhood, the first 10 years or so, was full of an openness to creativity, and how both of her parents were fairly creative people. And she had some fun stories about the things that she was allowed to do to express her creativity, like drawing pictures in chalk on the slate floor and having them be there for a week or so until the floor was washed, and riding her pony in the house and asking first, you know, may I do this? I mean, and they're fun and they're cute stories, but the reality of it is that was permission at an early age for somebody to be creative. And I think that has been a part of Amber, obviously, for the remainder of her journey as a founder. And she's still at it.
This allowed her the freedom to think big. And she definitely thought big for her last company. Some of those numbers she was quoting for the Pregnancy Plus app were truly impressive. And the fact that she sold it to a big company, you know, she picked up the phone, I think, and made that connection on LinkedIn, I think.
Yeah, that happened almost like you would read about in a novel about a successful entrepreneur, right? She was persistent and it all fell into place. And these results don't happen if somebody isn't driven and isn't results focused. And I liked her idea of bootstrapping, and you've probably had the same kinds of experiences in your venture.
Well, most startup businesses are bootstrapped for a long period of time. But it was interesting that Amber actually wanted to continue her bootstrapping experience and not take money, big money, let's say from VCs or private equity, because she wanted to be sustained mission driven, not chasing revenue necessarily, and making her app as free as possible to as many people as possible, rather than driving revenue, which perhaps a VC or a private equity firm sitting on the board might have compelled her to do. And she's taken that same theme to her new venture as well. She wants to give away as much of that revenue as possible to good causes.
This went through everything she was talking about. This whole concept of social impact, that was impressive. I mean, here's a person who is really cares. She wants to have a social impact. But the interesting thing about social impact is it brings with it internationality. You don't have a major social impact on one country. You have it on a set of people that are all over the world. And that brings its own set of challenges. That brings structurally and managerially and operationally, how do you do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And she had that experience at Philips when she had this big development center in Bangalore in India to develop software, where she wanted to improve local decision making and efficiency. And she said that in her new company, when she starts to grow it, she's going to have CEOs around the world, and she didn't want to be the figurehead CEO, and she wanted local decision making, which presumably would lead to a much more efficient organization as well.
Yeah, and she had that example about how do we say whatever in the language of this particular country? What words do we use? And rather than having some complicated process where somebody there has to send it up the line and it has to be approved at corporate and back down, she was talking about decentralized decision making, which is a very important concept if you're trying to run a company that is international, is global. And you have to do it in a way that maintains the integrity and the persona of the company, but gives a nod to and understands the fact that cultures, languages, etc. are different. So she seems to really be adept at that, which is impressive again.
And Shelley, that was a great way to end season three, wasn't it?
Absolutely, on a high note.
We've had some great guests on season three, really have. I've really enjoyed it as well, met some great people. And we've had some great feedback from our listeners, haven't we?
Yes. And you know what? I think it puts us on notice to have season four be as interesting, as exciting, maybe more so in some ways. And some of the guests that we've lined up already are definitely going to fill those large shoes, right, Blunt?
Absolutely. And we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back pretty soon with season four. We've already got a number of people lined up, as you say, Shelley. So I think season four is probably going to be even better and even more exciting.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to Startup Sensations. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform so you never miss an episode. Follow us on the Startup Sensations podcast LinkedIn page and watch video highlights on our YouTube channel. Get in touch with us. Email hello@startupsensations.com. The Startup Sensations Podcast.